Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we'll be talking about cancer and aging with Professor of Medicine and Director of Geriatric Oncology at UNC, Dr. Hai Muss.
Yeah, this is an important topic, Christy. So many patients and friends and family members dealing with cancer, they call it the scourge of our lifetime, but hopefully it's not all bad news and some good news.
Absolutely. But first, we've got some news about kids and allergies and risks associated with farms or not living on farms.
We'll talk about people leaving the hospital AMA. That's not the American Medical Association, but it's against medical advice.
We'll talk about different types of radiation for breast cancer.
And finally, how long do you drive to get to work, and does that have any effect on your health? Let's talk about our very first one, Christy.
Okay, so this is about kids who grow up on farms, and we know that...
Did you grow up on a farm?
I did not grow up on a farm, did you?
One might wonder. I visited a farm. My brother became a farmer. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Yes, he was a farmer in North Georgia, started the Organic Farmers Market of Georgia.
Interesting. Is that why you eat organic foods?
I did it before I was with visiting his farm, but I did enjoy going to his farm. But the question is, did myself or my children have less allergies and asthma as a result of going to his farm?
So there is some data to suggest that living outdoors and perhaps living on farms plays a role in sort of postponing or warding off asthma and possibly allergies. But this is a study kind of looking in more detail about this farm effect, or so-called farm effect related to allergies and
not
asthma.
Not pharmacist, but farm.
Yes.
Right. So 83,000 children who grew up in rural areas of Germany, Switzerland, and Austria, and it's good to know that there are lots of rural areas there like they are in the United States. And they looked at that 9,000 of these kids that were raised on a farm, 18,000 who visited other people's farms, kind of like myself visiting my brother's farm, and 52,000 who never spent time on a farm.
And what they found was sort of like a reverse dose effect, where 11% of the kids raised on a farm developed asthma, compared to 16% of those who visited the farms but weren't raised on one. And for the people who never spent time on a farm, 18% had asthma. So suggesting that somehow being around the farm and those, like the bacteria that's there, somehow that plays a role in protecting you from asthma.
Yeah, kind of like they said that maybe drinking the cow's milk or being around the straw, which is kind of, I mean, it's a little bit counterintuitive that, you know, you're around all these bacteria of animals and on the farms, but maybe there's this protective effect that somehow around these bacteria, maybe they're not as virulent, as bad, as bugs, as the kind that we are around when we're in closer proximity to one another. I don't know, Christy, though, if this doesn't mean we should, it's a good thing for us to all go visit farms. I love going to the farm. I think it's a great thing, but I'm not sure I would say do it because it's going to lead to less asthma or less hay fever or allergies.
Well, it'd be nice. I mean, I've always thought it was more about the clean air or the dirtier air, but maybe there is something to it. If we can figure out what it is, then maybe that could be applied to children who don't live on farms.
I think going
we can't
pick,
all live there, can
picking,
we?
Picking the blueberries and picking the strawberries, that's a good thing, because we know from one of our prior research that there's less problems as you get older with your memory.
That's
so
right.
Lots of good reasons to go to that farm. We don't know about the research, though, if it's fully developed yet.
Okay, let's do the next one. And this is a good question for you, Adam. Have you ever had a patient leave the hospital against your advice?
Absolutely not, Christy. My word is sanctimonious, Christy. You know that you know, it's like the word of no, it's not. I think every physician has probably had patients leave against medical advice.
Yeah.
I can think of one person who, you know, we said you probably should come in. You've had chest pain. We think you should come in to make sure you haven't had a heart problem. And they said, nope, I'm not going to do it because it's going to cost me several thousand dollars and I'm uninsured.
Well, and lots of people work together with their doctor. Maybe they want to go home a little sooner, or maybe it's sort of a soft call, and the patient's preference or ability to follow up might play a role in the discussion about whether or not to stay longer in the hospital or to come in. But this is in the setting of where someone, where the doctor recommends that you come to the hospital or stay there, and the patient says, I'm leaving against your advice. And usually doctors have you sign a little something saying that you understand
that you may die if you leave. Though the reality is, if you're leaving against medical advice, a lot of times you don't sign that little piece of paper saying that you release the hospital of all liability, but you leave. And the question is, are the people who leave at higher risk actually of bad outcomes, like dying?
Yeah. I mean, this was a study in the American Journal of Medicine suggesting that patients are at an increased risk of being readmitted after they leave against doctor's advice. But also, pretty strikingly, they're at an increased risk of dying within 30 days of leaving against medical advice.
Yeah. So both of those things suggest that you're at higher risk of bad outcomes if you leave against medical advice. But that doesn't mean that, you know, you have to do everything that the doctor says always. But I suspect, Christy, that a lot of the people who leave against medical advice, there's lots of things happening. It's not just, oh, it's the doctor's advice, but it is a question of cost. So if you're uninsured, this is a factor. It may be a function of how long you've waited in that emergency room. If you've been there for 18 hours, you might say, enough's enough.
Well, and it may have to do with going through the process of a proper discharge where we arrange good follow-up and really go over the medicines. It may be that people are leaving before they get good instructions about, you know, the best course of action to treat the situation.
Patient education and trust. We need to increase both of those to perhaps cut down on these folks leaving AMA. What's our very next research that matters?
Okay, this is about brachytherapy. So this is...
Brachytherapy?
I know, it's hard to say. I'm not even sure I'm saying it right.
B-R-A-C-H-Y therapy.
Yes. So this is where for breast cancer, you can put in a tiny, tiny little device, a balloon or a catheter into the breast to deliver a dose of radiation that would just work right around that little area compared with doing radiation on the whole breast for breast cancer.
And by that description, it would sound like, oh, this is a good thing to have done because there's less radiation to the entire breast. That might be less side effects. And a lot of times we hear about medical procedures like this, which on the surface sound wonderful. And if you describe them, if I were perhaps a woman with this type of need, I might say I should want to have this procedure. But the question is it really good for me?
Well, and they looked at this over 5 years following people out from people choosing the different types of radiation and found that the people who got this brachyradiation or the seed radiation as part of their treatment were more likely to have an infection, more likely to have breast pain, and even more likely to need a mastectomy down the road than the people who had the whole breast radiation.
None of those are good.
No, I mean, the differences were not huge. And both of them had low complication rates overall. But still, I mean, it just suggests that things that make common sense may not always pan out how
we
hope.
I think that this was in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and I think the bottom line here is you got a loved one that needs to have radiation for their breast cancer. Talk about the risk, talk about the benefits, and talk about the side effects of all of the therapies. And, you know, there is no free lunch to any therapy. And there may be some unintended consequences of this therapy that women and their loved ones need to know about. It's not just a blanket, you should go with this, because on theory, it may be less harmful, but it may not be in reality.
Well, and it's also not a blanket that this is bad, because
right.
It really does save a lot of women. And
education.
It is. It's a matter of talking with your doctor about those risks and benefits.
Let's speak about the very last research that matters, Christy, about how long you have to drive to get to work. How long do you drive to get to work?
Not long at all. 10, 15 minutes.
Yeah. So I'm a little bit less than
that. And the terrible traffic, but 7 minutes on a nighttime
call.
Right.
So less than 10 miles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's interesting is I took a bunch of our nurses out to lunch. And one of the things that kind of struck me was asking, you know, where do you live? And like half the group lived more than 30 miles away from our practice, which meant their commute is over an hour each way. And the question is, I mean, that sounds hard, and we know that this increasingly people are driving everywhere to get to work, but is there an impact on health?
That's true. My husband drives quite a long way to the various emergency departments in Wake County where he works. And so this really hits home for us. This is looking at greater commuting distances and an association with decreased heart fitness, increased weight, and other risk factors.
And so this was in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. And basically, they found if you commute more than 15 miles to work, you're less likely to fulfill the recommendations that different medical groups have for physical activity. You're more likely to be overweight. And if you commute more than 10 miles, you're more likely to have high blood pressure.
Well, and it makes sense that, you know, if you're talking about being sedentary, there's nothing very much more sedentary than just sitting in a car, have your foot on the gas, but that's about it. If you're doing that a long period of time, you can imagine that you'd have less time to exercise and more time in your day when you're not burning very many calories.
Right. It lets me know, Christy, I don't think I'm in the position yet where I'm the exercise czar or the work czar, or I never wanted us to be the czar, but maybe we need to create just much more availability of these sorts of activities at work. I'm not sure how we can, you know, change how far people live from their work, but we could maybe make work be more conducive for exercise.
My staff and I are going to start trying a few work meetings where we're walking now that the weather's good. So I would encourage you listeners out there to try to think of creative ways in your workplace to move your bodies.
Deal. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters, Christy. We've had a good chance to talk about ways of being aware and getting exercise, even with long commutes.
About patients leaving the hospital against medical advice.
About this brachytherapy, whether or not we put the brakes on it, it'll depend on more patient education.
And about kids who grow up on cow farms having fewer allergies and asthma.
We'll take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Hai Mus about cancer and aging. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Professor of Medicine and Director of the Geriatric Oncology Program at the University of North Carolina, Dr. Hai Mus, about cancer and aging.
Dr. Mus, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
I'd love to start out. It makes sense as you think about, you know, getting older is a risk factor for developing cancer. But for you as a cancer doctor, how did you begin to become passionate about these concepts of special needs of older patients with cancer?
Well, I was fortunate when I was a younger faculty at Wake Forest to have a terrific mentor, Dr. Bill Hazard, who actually is one of the premier and first geriatricians in the United States. And he tried to get all faculty interested in issues in older people. So I was a cancer specialist and was skeptical, but he got me to do a project with actually one of our residents. And it turned out to be so much fun and so enlightening that I ended up doing this as a career goal. I had always loved the stories of older people and taking care of older people, but putting it in context of what I did every day was terrific. So I guess it's great mentorship.
What was so fun about that particular project?
Well, I worked on, at that time, and possibly still, a lot of older people don't get state-of-the-art treatment because of age biases. People think they can't handle it or don't want it or don't offer them clinical trials. In our project, we looked at a series of clinical trials, and at that time, many clinical trials had a cap. They didn't take people over 70, but our trials did, and so we went and looked to see if the older patients, these were women with metastatic breast cancer, did as well as the younger patients. Did their tumor shrink as well? Did they shrink as fast? Did they have more side effects? And we found to our surprise that they actually did very, very well as a group. They did as well as the younger women. So it was very exciting, and it kind of opened my eyes to my own biases, because my predictions were that that they wouldn't have done as well. And so we've been following that theme since.
Well, I think that theme of maybe challenging biases is an important one. And I'm going to kind of throw out there a couple biases maybe that me, that myself and maybe my colleagues might have even, which is, you know, patients fear cancer in many respects more than most other illnesses other than perhaps Alzheimer's. And is developing cancer an intrinsic part of aging? And as our population ages and we have people living into their 90s and 100s more frequently, are we just going to see a continuing rise in cancer?
Absolutely. So what's shocking to many people is the average age of cancer in the United States of getting a diagnosis is age 67. And so when you look at the media and TV, it's always younger people, or when they have a telethon for cancer, it's always young Hollywood stars, but it's a disease of older people. And whether it's breast cancer, bowel cancer, leukemia, there's a steady increase in the incidence, the number of new patients per year per 100,000 population as we get older. So as we get older, more cancer, and Americans have been getting older now for probably the last 50 years. We're a healthier population. We're living to older ages, and we're seeing much more cancer in numerically and especially in older people.
Well, let's talk about some of the special needs or the special elements of the experience of having cancer, getting cancer at an older age versus those people who get it younger. What are the key differences or things that we need to think about?
Well, the key differences are that older people frequently who get cancer have many other diseases, frequently other diseases that although they may not have scary names like cancer, or they may be diabetes or heart disease, are equally, if not as serious as the cancer. And so the real challenge we have as physicians is trying to decide what are the how is the cancer going to play into all these other illnesses that patients may have? And if they have a lot of other illnesses, how is that going to affect the therapy? Certain therapies like surgery, radiation, or chemo too risky or not? So it's trying to sort out, and age alone is a surrogate for having other illnesses, but it's not good enough. We have to sort out by other illnesses, by function, how the cancer will affect that patient, and how will the treatment of the cancer affect that patient. And although older people have traditionally been undertreated, sometimes we overtreat people because we're not aware of the seriousness of their other non-cancer diseases. So it's quite a challenge.
Well, it is true that the cancer and its treatment and everything can often really usurp everything else.
Sure.
And many times for good reason, if that's the most important thing going on. But sometimes patients will sort of be whisked away by that and then come back years later after not having attended to some of those other problems. So putting it in that context, I do think is a real challenge.
Absolutely true. It's got to be a partnership with family physicians like yourselves, geriatricians, et cetera, to kind of work together to figure out how the cancer fits with all the other things that may be going on in an older patient.
It certainly may be the thing that makes those other things not as important. But as you say, it may also just be one piece of that broader context of a person's life. And it's tough to tease that out. It sounds like you really take a team approach.
Yeah, we do. We're geriatricians are in short supply in the United States. We're fortunately at UNC to have a terrific group, and we've kind of partnered with them. And what we're trying to do is use abbreviated assessments whereby we can teach our clinic personnel how to screen patients for cognitive function, for their ability to get up and walk across the room, and some basic functions in life. And then we're able to look at things like, are they able to live by themselves, use the telephone, pay their bills, are they eating well, falling, et cetera, doing all these other things in a very timely fashion so we can just put it all together and give the patient the best advice.
Speaking of advice, I know one of the issues as our population ages is in treating cancer,
do we have the sufficient research base to know if can people in their 80s or in some cases their 90s who maybe get diagnosed with cancers that we would treat maybe with chemotherapy in their 60s or 70s, what do we know about that? And I had recently, my father-in-law had been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in his middle 80s, but was really healthy. And the question was a difficult question to find out what type of research. What do we know and what's happening with research on cancer in aging populations?
Well, it's a great question, and we don't have the information we'd like. So historically, a lot of our clinical trials excluded older people, or physician bias led to not offering older people participation in trials. So although today we are open in our clinical trials where we learn a lot about this, we're still woefully short of information. What we have done is to go into some very large trials, and if they had older people, let's say people in their late 70s and 80s, because a 65-year-old person isn't old anymore, we go in and we see if we can sort out that data and see if those individuals did as well or not as well as the younger people in the trial, and also was the side effect profile different. So your example with a father-in-law and pancreatic cancer, we probably know very, very little about that, and this is the challenge, to get the information or, when it's not there, to try to make the best judgment as to what that patient might be able to tolerate.
Well, and there's so many questions that are unanswered about quality of life and also about life expectancy that needs to be a part of the conversation and the research. So I'll be interested in continuing this piece of the conversation after we take a break. We do need to take a break, but we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Muss, about cancer and aging when we come back. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Professor of Medicine and Director of Geriatric Oncology at UNC, Dr. Hai Muss, about cancer and aging. And before the break, Dr. Muss, we were talking about just the complexity and the lack of research that we have about quality of life and about length of life and whether or not cancer treatment and even knowing you have cancer is a good thing and is really going to improve life in those older years. Do you have, I know you have lots of experience, but do you have a recent story for us or something where you've had to weigh out some of those issues?
Absolutely. So it's an excellent question. So I recently saw a woman who was 86 years old, and she had a very serious type of breast cancer, one that using estrogen-blocking pills that are commonly used wouldn't work. And she went through surgery and did extremely well, and this was the type of breast cancer that probably had an 80% chance of coming back and claiming her life within a five-year period. And we have chemotherapy that we could offer her that would reduce that by at least half. So if you look at all the patients like this, they're not rare, that are coming in the doctor's offices. It's a big dilemma, 86 years old. So this woman happened to be extremely active, took care of herself, went in all the activities. She lived in one of the retirement communities. And we really soul-searched giving this person chemotherapy that we might give in a 50- or 60-year-old. And after a while, and of obviously getting her input and telling her the potential side effects, she said, I want to do it. And we did it, and actually she did extremely well. But I will tell you, I was always nervous treating her. Her estimated survival, which may get back to some of your earlier questions, was probably about 5 to 10 years. And I point out there are some very good web-based tools for healthcare professionals to look at estimated survivals that use some very simple questions and are very easy to do in the office. So this woman had a really good estimated survival, even though she was 86. And after a while, we decided to do the therapy. It was a very, very big decision. She happened to be a person with virtually no other major illnesses, which is why her outlook was so good. But it was very, very hard for me. And I use her as an example, but I'm sure we will do this again and someone will get a lot of side effects and balance it out. But these are the tough decisions that we are trying to make in the best way possible with the information we have.
Well, Dr. Moss, you share some distinctions, and I know we want to talk about them. One is this, you actually came to University of North Carolina from University of Vermont to start this geriatric oncology program, and I'm sure we really want to hear about your plans for that. But you also show a distinction that, to my knowledge, Christy, he's the first guest who we have a husband and wife on two different shows, and we had your wife on not too long ago talking about kind of the family approaches in the cancer center. And in the story you just told and in your work, I cannot but imagine that you're involving the family in these discussions. Tell me
how that
really works, like in the type of example you just gave. How do you involve the family?
Well, first I would say, following up on my wife, it's always good to marry up.
and good to acknowledge it on the air.
Absolutely. And my wife is really involved, and I learned a lot from her in patient and family-centered care. So the way we did this was certainly we talked to the patient and gave her a lot of information, but older patients culturally are a lot different than younger patients. They still look at the doctor in the old-fashioned way. In a way, it's a more patronizing doctor-patient relationship, which has historically been the case, but is changing. But in this instance, I got the family's this patient's. She actually had no children, but she had nieces and nephews that really loved her and were close to her. We all got together. We went over the side effects together. We worked out the logistics, not just the family, but where she lived. Is she going to be able to get to the clinic? What if she gets sick at night? What kind of help is available, et cetera? It's essential. All cancer is a family disease, but with older people, it is essentially to get the family into the discussions very early and obviously with the patient's permission, and make sure that everybody is on track with the goals of therapy. What are the goals? Is it to improve chances for cure? Is it to palliate symptoms? And also, what are the potential pitfalls of therapy?
Well, certainly.
So it is, as you say, it's a team game and it's a family game.
Well, and for those of our listeners who may have missed that show, it's worth going to our blog and listening to that show on cancer and families. Speaking of the teamwork and the future and thoughts about goals, you've got this program for geriatric oncology, and I'd love for you to just teach our listeners and us a little bit about how that is designed and what the goals are for the program.
So, first of all, I'm thrilled to be at the Leinberger Cancer Center at UNC. Dr. Earp, our director, and his colleagues have been really supportive of a program whereby we're trying to systematically evaluate as many older patients with cancer diagnoses as come into the cancer hospital for functional assessments. We're also looking with Dr. Ned Sharpless at molecular markers of aging, little genes whose proteins go up with age, and these proteins prevent our cells from dividing. And they're perhaps a very, very good marker of aging, and better than a lot of the other information and tests we can do on older people. And we're using these data to follow patients through these treatment. We get the molecular markers. We do the assessments. And then we're going to see how treatment affects function with the goal of, as we see what the patient's trajectory is, how are they doing with treatment? Are they getting a little numbness and tingling from chemo, and is that affecting their ability to care for themselves? And try to find these problems out early and then design interventions that keep the older people as functional as possible, as healthy as possible, and minimize side effects. So the program is very broad. It's in all types of cancers. We've got programs that are going on now and beginning for head and neck patients, for bladder cancer patients. And the aim is really to develop tools that are accurate that other doctors, nurses, healthcare professionals can use to take a patient and objectively kind of predict that patient's outcome with treatment, and then be able to present these information to the patient and family so that they could make a better decision. Some patients might accept some side effects for a little bit better outcome, and you know, as far as the cancer is concerned, but some might say, you know, I'm pretty comfortable the way I am and don't want to do it. So our program is kind of building this, and to date we've actually assessed about 650 patients in the last 2 years, and we've looked at a lot of molecular markers, and now we're starting to work on some of the interventions we can do. But it's very exciting, and it's from my perspective, it's a privilege to be here and have this support.
Well, I know Dr. Earp, the director of the Leinberger Cancer Center, said about you that you are a national treasure and that your clinical research accomplishments are outstanding, but secondary to your skills as a doctor, teacher, and colleague. And I think we're getting to hear a little bit about both of those and get a sense in our listeners to understand how fortunate UNC is to have you here. But I want to ask you one final question, if we can, which is, we started with understanding a little bit about the biases. And one of the biases that I sometimes see in my role is also clinically providing tobacco cessation services to patients of all ages is that we don't think that prevention sometimes for older patients is worth it. I know that you have an interest in the prevention of cancer as well in older populations. Can you tell us a little bit about the type of work that you think we need to be looking at?
Well, I think prevention is very complicated. When we think of prevention, we think of, you know, habits that are good, like sensible diets and avoiding smoking and excess things like alcohol, et cetera. And I think those are generic and perhaps good for all of us. But when we think of a lot of prevention, we're also thinking of tests we do, like mammograms and colonoscopies. And I must say, a lot of these tests, which have been shown to be a value in a large percentage of the population, have never really looked at older people, people in their 70s and 80s, as to their value. This is why we have the controversies on mammography and even things like colonoscopy.
So people shouldn't necessarily think, oh, I should keep having my colonoscopy
exactly
when I'm 85 or mammograms through my 80s.
Exactly. And in fact, it's questionable. And it really goes back to what, you know, if you're in great health at 75 and you're playing tennis and you're estimated to live another 10, 20 years, a mammogram to find a small cancer that may or may not prove to be a major problem in your life is probably reasonable. But if you're 80 years old and you have diabetes or another illness, to look for a small cancer that may not be consequential, what we're calling overdiagnosis now and has become a very popular term, it may not be appropriate. And so I think as we get older, the patient, and these tests are not done by cancer specialists, they're done by family practitioners and internists and geriatricians. The patient really needs to sit down and talk with that doctor and say, look, what's the value of this test? You know, what are we expecting to find? Is this likely to be a problem in my lifetime in the first place? And I think a lot of people don't need these tests, quite honestly.
Well,
very controversial statement because we're all into prevention, et cetera, but these tests are probably not needed in all older people.
Well, and it speaks, again, to individualizing a patient in the context of their life and a relationship with a doctor they can communicate well with. Thank you for being one of those doctors who really advocates for our patients and connects and listens to patients and their families, and for taking time to talk with us today about your work on cancer and aging.
Well, you've been so nice, and I appreciate the opportunity to spread our cause.
Thank you, Dr. Muss. And leading sometimes does mean sometimes saying things that are controversial. So thank you for leading.
Well, thank you very much.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the house call segment of our show today, Adam and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
And Christy, we got some great questions today that people have sent their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And let's listen to our very first question today about prostate cancer.
I worry a great deal about prostate cancer. Now that we seem to know the PSA is not a good test, what should I do? Should I still get a prostate check every year?
Well, you are asking the same question as many men in America and many women who care about their loved ones.
Yeah, we're getting this daily increasing. And I don't know if we have a great answer for you, but we will have some answers.
Well, I think it is a very personal decision that you should weigh out with your doctor of, if you get this test done and it's elevated, how much worry will that cause you? Are you able to sort of stop the chain of events if you decide not to pursue it? How much do you want to know if you have a slow-growing cancer, depending on what age you are and the risk to your life? Do you really want to know that?
Well, and I think the question, Christy, of, you know, if you assume that the PSA is not a good test anymore, let's just make that assumption, which it is, that's what we know. Do you still get a digital prostate exam? And what's the utility of that exam? Because we know that it doesn't necessarily, you're not going to diagnose something early. So do you still get a digital prostate exam? And I'd say most authorities say you probably should.
Most of us say that, but it's not the most what we call sensitive or specific test. And it's very limited exam itself. So I wouldn't
really
rely on that either.
We don't really have a great test to check for prostate cancer. That's the simple truth. We can need decision tools to help educate, but unfortunately, until we have something better, we're going to have these long, difficult conversations.
It's absolutely true.
Let's listen to our very next house call.
I am 55 and have had cellulitis in my leg several times. My doctor recently said it could be coming from my chronic fungus on my feet. What do you think?
I think you got a pretty smart doctor there. That's a pretty good observation. Not everyone would think about looking at the feet when you got a problem like cellulitis of the leg, but yeah, absolutely.
It could be from some sort of chronic infection in your feet, like fungus. It also could be related to the blood flow that you have to your legs or how your veins drain or if you have diabetes or some other problem that makes it hard for you to heal. There are lots of reasons why people can get recurrent or ongoing cellulitis that has to do with the blood flow.
Yeah. And we certainly hope, and it's really good, though, that you have a provider who's thinking about what's causing it, not just treating, because the treatment is pretty straightforward. But again, if you don't look for something, you won't find it. So in this case, kind of a cream that you probably put on your feet till the fungus goes away, and maybe even longer, that might cure your fungus and hopefully your cellulitis. Thank you so much for sending us your question.
Let's take our next house call question.
Recently, I went to my family doctor for what I thought was conjunctivitis. I had a pain in my eye and it was red. He examined it and he said he was worried about something more serious, that I might need steroid eye drops rather than antibiotics, and he arranged for me to see an ophthalmologist later that day. The eye doctor said I had inflammation in my uvea and he put me on steroid drops. What is uveitis? And thanks to my family doctor for making the right diagnosis.
Uveitis, that's a fancy word and one that maybe most of our listeners haven't heard of. They've heard of a conjunctivitis or inflammation on that outer layer of the eye, and this is the middle portion of the eye.
And this is usually like what you're describing, where the eye is red, you might get some blurry vision, there's often a sensitivity to light. Some people get like floaty spots, but pain in the eye is a big piece of this.
Right, and I think sometimes doctors kind of say everything is conjunctivitis when not everything is conjunctivitis. In this case, that inflammation may not be caused from a bacteria or even a virus. It may be some other condition for which, in this case, like you said, they might need steroid drops. And so kudos to the family doctor who was suspicious enough to get you in to see the ophthalmologist and get that treatment going.
Thanks for your comment and for your question.
Let's listen to our very last house call.
I have had bad psoriasis for many years, but I really did not think it could be treated. I was told by my family physician that dermatologists can treat really bad psoriasis with good results. I went to see a dermatologist on referral, and after a year of treatment with light therapy and acetitrin, it is much, much better. I just wanted to share that story.
What do you think, Christy? Psoriasis, I find it a common condition that's sometimes difficult to treat. We don't realize how hard it is sometimes for our patients and even for the providers to get this really well controlled.
Well, and I think that's the thing is about control. There's a wide variation of psoriasis and how bad it is, how bothersome it is to a person. And then there's also some education, I think, about whether or not you cure it and make it go away forever versus kind of keeping it at bay, which requires you to sort of respond early to the flares and do the creams and medicines that your doctor recommends.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of family docs are familiar with a lot of the topical medications, mm-hmm. so the topical steroids, and they have these vitamin D type medicines that patients can use. And we sometimes do recommend a little bit of sunlight or coal tar. But when you get into that disease that's harder, we don't frequently probably have as much experience with things like phototherapy or the systemic drugs that people can take but can have dramatic impacts on their lives, like with this patient.
Well, and I think it's always worth, I mean, the field of dermatology, as with many fields of medicine, is advancing, you know, every day, every year. And so with a lot of these chronic ongoing conditions, there are new and different treatments. And so that's why it's important to have a doctor that works well with the specialty colleagues to refer and say, well, what else is out there?
Kudos to the dermatologist here working with the team approach here. And that'll conclude our house calls today, Christy, but we've had a chance to not only talk about psoriasis, but this uveitis.
We talked a little bit about ongoing cellulitis and fungus and about that not-so-great test for prostate cancer.
Any of them. But thank you for your questions. We thank you for joining us today at Your Health. We hope we've answered questions and stories that are important to you. And you can send us your comments at yourhealth@unc.edu and visit us online at yourhealthradio.org.
We want to thank the staff of WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Chaim Muss. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We'll talk with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.